welcome everyone to today's internet seminar, which is part of the OSC Readiness series in preparation for the OSC Readiness. This webinar is being sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I'm with the Superfund program, and I'm going to moderate today's session. I'm going to get the webinar started in a few moments, but while we're waiting for people to log on, I'm going to cover a few housekeeping items, and you'll see these items on slide number one and slide number two of the webcast that you have open for today. So when you registered, you were given the specific URL for the seminar, and this is the front page of the webinar that you see on the webinar seminar page. And the front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have some bio sketches of the presenters along with their email addresses, which are hot links. So if you have any questions after today's session, you'll know how to get in touch with the presenters. For those of you who are joining on the phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will address questions throughout the seminar, and we'll also make some time for you to speak up and ask questions. But while we're just doing the presentation, we would like to have you muted because if you're not muted, a lot of times it can greatly reduce the background, or it can create background noises that can disrupt the quality of our audio transmission. So if you don't have a mute button on your phone, we do ask that you take the moment right now to hit *6, which will place your phone on mute. And then when we get to a point where you can ask questions, we'll have you hit #6, and I will remind you of that to unmute your phone. Also, don't put us on hold, because a lot of times organizations will have hold music or advertisements that can also disrupt the call. So by now, all of you should have clicked onto the agenda for today on the GoTo session icon, and you should be on slide number one of the presentation. The main page, you'll see the slides, above which are some orange buttons, which are the navigation icons. You can submit questions by using the question mark icon that you see above the slide. And you don't have to wait to submit a question for any question and answer period. Like I said, we will be addressing questions as appropriate throughout the session. So we encourage you to submit your questions in advance and just submit them as you think of them, and we'll see them come in. If you do experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can also use the question mark icon to alert us of your technical difficulty. We do ask that you provide us with your phone number so we can reach you to help troubleshoot your problem. We have two presenters today, and as they move through their session, they're going to announce the number of the slide to which they're moving to. And you can advance to the next slide by using the single right arrow located at the top of the slide, or you can also click on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. So like I mentioned, we will address questions throughout the session. And at the end of the presentation, we'll also show you some links to additional resources. And also, I would like you to know that any resources we have will stay with the seminar indefinitely. We are archiving this session. And in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And all those live links will be there. So, and then we do have a feedback form at the end that we ask you to complete, because we do look at those in trying to improve the content and delivery of our webinars. So with that, I think we're ready to start our session. We will have two speakers today. The first one will be Sarah DeCare, who's a health physicist with EPA's Center for Radiological Emergency Management. And there she has been for 7 years and has worked on policy, procedures, and training related to emergency response and radiation protection. And then our second speaker is Catherine Sneed, and she's been an environmental scientist with EPA's Radiation Protection Division for over 10 years. She's currently a program analyst for the Center for Radiological Emergency Management and chair of the Multi-Agency Radiation Survey and Site Investigation Manual Work Group. So I'd like to welcome our two speakers. And as a reminder, just keep us on mute, and we'll let you know when you can speak up and ask some questions. So, Sarah, it's all you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. Catherine and I are glad to be able to speak to you today, and we have just a few related topics. Do you want the phone closer?
Just wondering if everyone can hear you.
Does it sound okay?
Yeah, it sounds great.
Thank you. Okay. I'm just going to provide a little perspective here. I think we're going to head into the slides. Let's see, housekeeping, we covered that one. So on slide 3, RERP updates roadshow, I just want to provide a little context for why we're doing a roadshow. If you page to slide 4, it says RERP updates roadshow. And why are we here to talk about this? What are we interested in? Well, mainly every few years it's a good idea to remind EPA responders, EPA regional staff, headquarters, on-scene coordinators, what's going on with radiological emergency preparedness. For one, because incidents don't happen that often. Of course, in recent history, we've had too much experience, frankly. The Japan nuclear power plant incident back in March that we're still helping deal with was certainly a very exciting time for us when suddenly everybody was thinking about radiological emergency preparedness. We always want to keep people apprised of what the Office of Radiation and Indoor Air is doing, how we participate in regional activities, and getting people ready to collaborate and cooperate in a radiological emergency in case one happens. And we also, of course, want to open it up and say, you know, let us know if you have questions, let us know if you have concerns. We're here to help. We're part of the Radiological Emergency Response Team, and we want to just give you an update on a couple things related to Radiological Emergency Response Plan, Program, Protective Action Guides, which I'll talk more about later, and then about MARSIM. So with that, I'm going to hand it back to Catherine, who's going to talk about the RERP.
All right. If you want to move forward, we're actually going to talk a little bit about two recent radiation incidents. We've got really two scenarios that we're looking at right now in the United States in terms of how EPA responds to radiation emergencies. The first kind of incident has a specific site that we're working with here someplace within the United States, and as a result, we've actually had one of those incidents very recently. The Las Conchas fires incident down in New Mexico, which actually did not end up releasing any radiation, but since there was the possibility for that, we treated it as if there was some potential there, and we responded accordingly. So just moving forward, I think, to the next slide, you can see one of the pictures of the fire and the smoke coming out of there. The Las Conchas fire response was actually being led out of EPA Region 6. The Las Conchas fire began in late June. It continued into July 2011, and it ranks as the largest wildfire in New Mexico's history. Now, the Radiological Emergency Response Team, as a special team here at EPA, deployed in support of Region 6's response. We performed air monitoring in several locations around the fire. Well, why would we do that? There was some concern that the fire could spread to portions of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, especially areas where radioactive waste and facilities handling radioactive materials, especially plutonium, were located. When the fire was contained to the point where it was clear it would not spread to those portions of Los Alamos National Laboratory containing radioactive materials or waste, the RERT did demobilize. That gives you an idea of why we were out there and what we had hoped to do. We'll move forward to slide number 7, where you can get a good view of what we brought out there. Our RERT mobile command post is the one you'll see right there in the foreground, and we are parked under smoky skies right next to the Region 6 mobile command post right behind. So once again, this is an incident where there is a specific site within the United States. Our EPA region is going to take the lead on that, in this case, Region 6. So they are out there, and our Radiological Emergency Response Team is out there in support of them. Moving on to slide number 8, this is a picture of the New Mexico Emergency Operations Center. EPA and all of its operational groups were working very closely with New Mexico and affected localities to support their overall response. It's not EPA out there independently. We're incorporated into a much larger response structure. Moving on to slide number 9, you'll see some of the air samplers that we put up. Typically, we're looking to locate these air samplers in locations where they will not be encountered easily by members of the public, where they have some protection near the fire, close enough to the fire that we can get a reasonable sample from them. Pictured here, kind of clockwise from top left, we're looking at a sampler located near the Cochiti Town Hall. That was actually the closest town to the fires that was pretty significantly threatened by those fires at the time. The next one is the roof of the Buffalo Thunder Casino near the Pueblo of Pewaukee. And then we're looking at the Water Sanitation District property in Peña Blanca. What we're looking at, what we deployed was a medium volume sampler in order to potentially capture radioactive material, knowing that it's going to be carried in fairly heavily particle-laden winds from the fire. So kind of a specific setting there, specific to the fire and the circumstances we found it in. Then moving on to slide number 10, you'll see what we were doing kind of within that command post you saw early on. We had 8 individuals mobilized as part of our radiological emergency response team working out of that mobile command post. We were there for several days. We have Wes Boyd and Natalia Brooks, top left, Greg Dempsey, who was our RERT commander for the incident, top right, and then Fernando Gomez carrying out various capacities for various roles for this particular incident. You can't really read it, but the bottom left photo is our very high-tech rendition of where all of our samplers were and what their current status was, kind of keeping that up to date for all of the responders that were there. As it was at the end, when it was determined that the fires were not going to be threatening any of the radiological materials or waste there at the site, we did pack up and go home. Apparently, the fires did burn some small portion of the Los Alamos National Laboratory land, but not lands that contained any significant radiological materials. And as far as I know, we never picked up anything significant on any of our monitors. That's just kind of a recent deployment for our first scenario, which is one that contains a site within the United States. Now, moving on to slide number 11. We're going to talk a little bit about the Japan foreign nuclear incident in 2011. Many of you are very familiar now with the picture of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. This is the before picture, of course, before the incidents occurred.
May I interrupt you because there's a question?
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
There's a question from Lindsay Bender, who's probably down the hall. And she's asking if the air samplers that we used at Las Conchas were RadNet samplers.
Do you want to back up to them?
Sure. So looking at the medium volume air samplers, those actually are not RadNet air samplers. RadNet stations have a lot more gobbledygook associated with them. They're positioned to do very long-term monitoring, so they have a lot more stuff associated, more equipment, weather stations, so lots more electronics, and telemetry and other types of samplers. These are just portable air samplers that RERT stores at our 2 laboratories and keeps ready to go to throw in the field quickly when needed. Does that answer the question, I hope? I think so. I'm going to say Mark has answered.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, no problem. Okay, let's go back to slide 11.
Okay. So for the Japan foreign nuclear incident in 2011, most of you are very aware of that incident, but just in case you could use a refresher, this is the result of a 9.0 earthquake. There was in the Washington Post today a graphic that showed that was 63,000 times bigger than the 5.8 that rocked Washington, D.C. So just to give us an idea of how big that was. We're looking at that 9.0 earthquake and the subsequent tsunami off the coast of Japan, Friday, March 11th, 2011. Infrastructure was badly damaged there at the plant, and one nuclear power station, this is the Fukushima Daiichi that you're looking at there in the picture, severely damaged with a loss of cooling to the nuclear power plant, resulting in radiological releases. The U.S. response, nuclear experts and a response team from the Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and Nuclear Regulatory Commission went to Japan to support their nuclear safety and public protection efforts. All federal agencies with responsibility in public health, nuclear safety, transportation, food, and agriculture engaged in monitoring the events to evaluate the possibility of an environmental or health impact here in the United States, and of course, including EPA. Here's kind of one image from EPA's response. We activated our headquarters emergency operations center, including the advisory team for environment, food, and health. That's an advisory team that includes representatives from EPA, USDA, and Health and Human Services, including CDC and FDA. I think virtually at this point, kind of led from EPA's headquarters EOC. We set up a science tiger team to answer technical issues corresponding to the incident. We set up a very robust public information group and also an environmental unit to work with information and data coming out of our monitoring network. The photo you're looking at here on slide 12 is showing our public information officers hard at work in our EOC. Moving forward to slide 13, you can see kind of a picture of our radiation monitoring network. This is really kind of the heart of the response, is determining what effects came to the United States and its territories from Japan. One big part of that was our RadNet monitoring system. What you can see there are, you can see, I think the pink, or I suppose they might be supposed to be red, but on this particular picture they look pink, our fixed stations. Those are going to be fixed air monitoring stations. They're located all over the United States, and the number's pretty high at the moment. I'm looking at
over 120.
Here.
I think it's 123 or 4 at this point. Depends on the day.
Right. They're adding some, so I'm never familiar of the exact number, but you can see those marked there in the pink. And then in addition, EPA sent out deployable air monitors to those locations marked in blue. And of course, those are going to be clustered kind of on along our Pacific Rim states and territories, to get an idea of how the incident was affecting them. Deployable air monitors sent to Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, California, Guam, and Saipan specifically. In addition to the air monitoring that was going on, RadNet also includes milk, drinking water, and precipitation samples collected periodically. The pace of that sampling was in fact increased during late April or late March and April to accommodate this incident as well. Those are not actually pictures. So moving on to slide number 14, you can get kind of a picture of what this looks like. We're a little proud of our Nome, Alaska deployable. That's what you're looking at there in the top left-hand corner. I think when we first set out to deploy a deployable to Nome, Alaska, we were informed that the operating conditions there were harsh, but I think that we didn't know exactly how harsh they were. We found that our electronics froze within the samplers. It worked remarkably well considering, but we used that picture kind of to show how challenging those circumstances were. Down in the bottom right photo, you can see kind of a picture of a fixed station. There's one that's been there for a while in Fontana, California. In both of these, you can see what Sarah was saying about them containing more equipment, more electronics, a full weather station, and so on, so that they can operate independently and they don't have to have an operating team out to them, you know, constantly keeping track of them. These are meant to be operating with operators visiting them periodically to collect samples and keep them moving. Moving on to slide number 15, you can see what happens. The filters from these air monitoring stations are sent back. You can see all of the manila envelopes. I think pretty much each one of those is a filter sent from one of those stations someplace around the country. They are all sent back to our National Air and Radiation Environmental Laboratory, NARAL, which is located in Montgomery, Alabama. They have a 24/7 operation there to count samples, and they increased attention to near real-time RadNet data from monitors that are located right there on the station. So keeping kind of track of both of those things to look for effects in the United States. I think that kind of sums up the two different scenarios we'd be looking at. One where there's a site someplace within the United States that's in that particular case, the radiological emergency response team and the radiation program would be in support of the region and the regional response. The second is going to be a foreign nuclear incident that impacts the entire United States, and that's going to be one where the radiation program, primarily using its RadNet monitoring system, is going to be answering those public health questions there. So just pausing at this point to see if anyone has any additional questions kind of on those two incidents or our response to them before we move on.
Anyone who's on the phone line, you can speak up too. You can unmute us. If you use the keypad, you can hit #6 to unmute.
All right, hearing nothing, I think we're going to I'm going to turn this over to Sarah, as a matter of fact, to talk about our ORIA regional role.
Okay. Sarah. Thank you, Catherine. You surprise me all the time. ORIA regional roles, I'm going to talk about the Office of Radiation and Indoor Air, our regional radiation programs a little bit, just for perspective. So I'm moving on to slide 17, where you'll see that we'll just describe briefly what's going on with these ORIA regional radiation program roles. The idea is that the Radiation and Indoor Air Office and the Radiological Emergency Response Team can't all be in one place. In fact, we have two national laboratories in Las Vegas and in Montgomery that Catherine mentioned. And also we have people who work in all 10 of the regions and run a radiation program that it varies by region. Some of them have radioactive materials that are used in response, and they take care of those materials. Some of them have more of a laboratory that handles some radioactive materials, and some are mainly to provide advice and support in case the RERT has to deploy, say, to the region. In all 10 regions, we have staff and capabilities, including two roles that I'll describe a little more fully. Again, in support of RERT's deployment in an incident. We have routine meetings. We really pull together and coordinate with local, state, and regional response capabilities. We keep in touch so that the locations all, you know, are functioning on the same playbook, and trying to maintain a state of readiness in case there is a radiological emergency. As you saw from the two examples Catherine described, every once in a while they happen. So switching now to slide 18, regional roles for supporting the radiological emergency response program. These two roles, we call them the regional RERT liaison and the regional radiation advisor. And the liaison is much more of a coordination role. They are an RERT position. They're part of the support team, so they're not a forward field deployed person. But they help kind of bridge some of the coordination needs, logistics needs, and communications between a regional emergency response program that may not be totally familiar with radiological emergency response team and what RERT needs in order to deploy and what information we would be asking for. The other role, regional radiation advisor, in an emergency, this person is much more in the technical translator role. As you might be well aware, radiation sometimes is a little hard to explain. Especially to people who don't have familiarity with it, but like regional management and people who are making decisions for the agency, people making decisions for public health protection, may need some real robust technical advice to help translate radiation terms because they're complicated. So those two roles are something that we would stand up immediately in the case of an incident. Some regions have enough staff to support that at any time, and some regions help support each other through a process of backup regions, and I'll talk about that a little more in a second. Switching now to slide 19, a little more description on the regional RERT liaison. This responsibility includes a couple jobs, some support, logistics, communications, coordination. They provide the impacted regions with some direct links to RERT and what they need. I mentioned logistics and support. And like I said, if they have enough people there who can fulfill these roles, they would support that themselves, but the regions do back each other up through an MOA. The other roles, in a little more detail, I gotta switch to slide 20, good call. This regional radiation advisor, this is a role that I would much more likely fill because I tend to translate radiation terms when needed, do that translation role for managers or whoever needs to have some advice. They coordinate with affected federal, state, and local radiation programs. They help coordinate resources if needed, work with the regional response center during an emergency, and what we do to support preparedness for this is make sure that we conduct a lot of training, exercises, participate in a lot of activities with local and state entities to make sure that we're well connected and well prepared to perform this role in the region. And moving on to slide 21, here's our information, contact information for Catherine and I. If you think of any questions or if you think of any comments or feedback you'd like to give us on this presentation, ways to help us do better in conveying this information, please let us know. I'm going to stop there for a moment and ask if anybody has questions, comments, before we move on to the next topic. Okay, hearing nothing, we're going to keep on going. So I'm going to switch now.
Just a moment, please.
Go ahead.
Do we have a list of all the RERT liaisons?
We can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me now? Hello?
Hey, who is that? Dan Meir?
Yeah. How you doing? Is there a list of RERT liaisons?
Yeah, I was going to actually say the names of the regional radiation program managers if you want me to, because I'm sure these are people you know.
Are they the same? In other words, is Bandrowski the RERT liaison for Region 9?
No, we have a list. I can't list all those right now. Each regional radiation program is aware of that because we did identify people who fit these functional descriptions and have the capability. So we can get that to you.
That'd be great. Thanks.
Okay. List of.
Anyone else? It sounded like there was maybe one other question that was coming. Okay, I think Sarah is going to continue now. If you move on to slide number 23 with the PAGS manual update.
Okay, so let's talk about PAGS. It's a term of art, Protective Action Guides. It's an acronym. It's a bit of an outdated term, but it is a term of art and well-known in the radiation protection community, so we pretty much can't change the name at this point. But what I'll do is just do a brief update and talk a little bit about what PAGS are, what they do. If you switch now to slide 24, here's the PAGS manual. It's a green cover book that is no longer in print. Catherine is laughing at me.
I'm sorry, the still useful is cracked me up.
Well, I insist that the 92 PAGS, while old, are not bad. And it's true that our office has been working on updating this manual for several years. The good news is there's nothing wrong with the old one. These PAGS are
still used. Their main use actually is around nuclear power plants in the surrounding communities. Emergency preparedness around nuclear power plants is based on these protective action guides. And I'll tell you more about what PAGs are, but the good thing about the 92 PAGs is, like I said, they're robust, they're still useful, the values are staying the same, we really believe in their basis. And there was a symposium in 1992 looking at other incidents like transportation accidents or satellite reentry containing radioactive material, other types of incidents that involved radiation, and the experts decided that really the PAGs apply very well to things other than nuclear power plants. So we often say that the scope has been expanded because of that symposium to include any radiological incident. Sometimes we say short of nuclear war, but then I often caveat that by saying in no way PAGs would really be useful or helpful in a nuclear war. So, moving on to slide 25, what is a PAG? Here's a very detailed definition of what a protective action guide is. It's a value against which to compare a projected dose to a defined individual to recommend an action to avoid that dose. Now, I'll break that down because that's a bit much. Projected dose is a calculated value where someone like me, a radiation expert with some calculator tools or some estimator tools, might be able to say, well, based on what I know about this incident, people around this area may experience a radiation dose of, say, 35 millirem. And that would be over a certain time frame, and we have calculator tools. We're very specific about how that's calculated, and it may or may not be warranted based on that projection, that future dose calculation, to take an action to get people out of the way, generally moving people, like evacuating. This PAGS manual is merely guidance. It's not a regulation. It has been picked up by NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and FEMA for use around nuclear power plants. So it's basically implemented in all the emergency response plans around nuclear power plants. And these PAGs have been in use for decades for that purpose. It is important to note that projected dose to avoid is totally different from, say, a dose limit or an exposure limit where no action potentially would be taken until you reach that limit. This is much more a proactive approach where you guesstimate what the projected dose might be and take an action before that dose is incurred. Moving on to slide 26, for years now we've talked about radiological emergency planning in terms of incident response phases. And these are terms of art that are very commonly used, again, in the nuclear power plant emergency preparedness arena. The early phase is the first hours to days until the release has stopped. So if you look at, say, the Japan nuclear power plant incident, that had a series of releases that went on for days and days and days. That was a very long early phase. There were airborne radioactive material concerns for many days during that situation. It was a horrible situation and had a very long early phase. So protective actions during that early phase might be taken based on very little information. We were trying to glean as much information as we could, as the Japanese officials were trying to get as much information as they could to try to make decisions to try to protect the public before all the measurement data was actually in hand. The next phase, the intermediate phase, is weeks to months, though this is flexible, these time frames are flexible. When you have more information, you've got a little more radiological monitoring data, protective actions can be informed by that, and the protective actions are more restrictive. Frankly, after the crazy emergency phase has wrapped up and a little more is known, more calm and deliberate actions can be taken based on more detailed information. Certainly during the intermediate phase, cleanup planning would begin because, of course, as soon as possible, there would be mitigation, decontamination, and cleanup. And I'll, again, say for the Japan nuclear plant incident, right now they're definitely in the intermediate phase in Japan, and the actions that they've taken already, like evacuations and relocating people for longer term, are now being looked at in terms of when can people go back in. and they're allowing people to go back in on a temporary basis. They're looking at neighborhoods and doing cleanups and reducing the radiation dose of people so that they can get people back home and back to their communities. Then the last phase, the late phase, really no longer an emergency response, not really part of the disaster side of things, but activities shift much more to long-term cleanup, something that EPA is very interested in, of course, but it really isn't what the PAGS manual is all about. The PAGS manual is all about guidance for emergencies so that to take some of the guesswork out of how to respond and protect people during a radiological emergency. Now I'm moving on to slide 27, and here's where the numbers are. This is some people's favorite part, but others don't really love radiation units. But this is just a little primer and some numeric information about what these PAG levels are. So for the early phase, again, this is a 300-page document, so it's a little more detailed than this, but this is just a very basic primer. The protective actions that are recommended in the PAGS manual are either evacuation or shelter in place. And the PAGS manual is not specific about which one you should choose. That's very much a local decision. Decision makers might weigh the options of, you know, what time of day it is, what the weather conditions are, what the size of the population is, to determine whether evacuation or shelter in place is the best idea. And that PAG level is 1 to 5 REM over 4 days or 96 hours. Now, 1 to 5 REM, that's a range. And again, the PAGs don't say that you should always use 1 or always use 5. Most organizations, for instance, state radiation control programs that provide advice to the communities around nuclear power plants, use 1. 1 REM over 4 days. If your calculations show that members of the public might hit that dose level if they stay put, it may be warranted to move them, have them evacuate. The next bullet is KI, which is potassium iodide. That's a pill that can be taken to flood the thyroid with non-radioactive iodine to fill it up so that it doesn't have any room for radioactive iodine. Now, that probably sounds like a very super specific kind of treatment. It's not the anti-radiation pill. It doesn't protect against anything else, only radioactive iodine, and it only protects the thyroid. The only reason you'd be interested in that as a protective action is if there's iodine coming out of, say, a nuclear power plant. And there definitely was a lot of iodine that came out of the Japan nuclear power plant, so much so that we even measured it here in the U.S. The Chernobyl incident in 1986 was one of those cases where there was iodine coming out of a nuclear power plant, and many children in the area who were exposed to iodine got thyroid cancer, a fairly aggressive thyroid cancer. So KI is one of those things that's super specific but can be helpful in certain radiological incidents. That guidance is actually from the Food and Drug Administration, and EPA just incorporates it and says FDA has provided guidance and we agree with it. And then that third bullet there is about workers. Now, this is radiation workers, emergency response people who would be going in to help address this radiological emergency. And these levels are really actually not PAGs. These are guidelines that are in the PAGs manual, but they're not the same kind of basis. They are not projected doses. They're more like dose limits. So making calculations ahead of time to reduce dose and keep it as low as reasonably achievable is good, but they're much more like dose limits, and those are 5, 10, and 25. There are different values for different types of activities because all emergency response operations should be limited to 5 REM for the duration of the incident, but certain special circumstances might warrant workers going up to 10 REM if they're protecting critical infrastructure or protecting large populations. Another level is 25 or higher REM, and that would be associated with something as critical as life-saving. 25 REM definitely gets into the potential increased cancer risk and some early acute radiation effects, so it would really have to be worth it to take that kind of radiation dose. So I see a question over on the side from Craig Scott. Let's see. The conversion for KI dose millisievert is not consistent with the other two conversions. I can go back and look at that. I think we probably have a correction that we need to do. Oh, yeah, 5 is not 250. Good catch, Craig. Thank you for that. I will correct that on slide 27. Okay. So I'm going to stop there and ask if there are questions. I'm going to, my next slide, 28, is about the intermediate phase. Does anybody have any questions on the phone? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move on. So on slide 28, here are the numbers for the intermediate phase. Again, remembering that the crazy emergency phase has kind of wrapped up at this point. The release has terminated. So again, intermediate phase is where we are in the Japan incident over there. This is where actions have a little more information to go on. The actions are potentially to protect people from a much longer-term situation. And if there is a large radiological release, say from a nuclear power plant or some other type of incident, potentially there could be concerns for years to come from radioactive material that has settled on the ground or in neighborhoods, at businesses. So the protective actions recommended in the intermediate phase are relocation, which is a term of art. It's really the long-term removal of people from communities, from businesses or homes. It doesn't say how long. The PAGS manual doesn't specify how long you would relocate. It has to be an incident-specific decision. But these thresholds, these PAG levels, are in terms of REM per year. So the relocation PAG is 2 REM in the first year. Again, this is a projection. We can do projections for a year on day one. We can use our calculator tools to say members of the public, based on what we know about the incident and the levels, might experience up to 2 REM in that first year. And again, that's the level that's being implemented in Japan right now. Japan has recommended that their citizens relocate, move away for an undefined period of time if their projected dose would be 2 REM in that first year. There's another relocation PAG which talks about later times, half a REM in any subsequent year, the second and further on. That's aimed at more long-lived radionuclides, which certainly the Japan incident does involve cesium, which is fairly long-lived. So that's looking at whether doses would be high later in life, maybe not in the first year, but as time wears on. So we use those calculations in tandem to help recommend relocation decisions. Any doses projected lower than that relocation PAG, the PAGS manual recommends.
No, thank you.
Is there a question out there? The PAGS manual recommends using dose reduction techniques, and it goes into a little bit of detail in the manual about what those are. Those could be simple decontamination and mitigation techniques, some of which citizens can take on their own, like washing off rooftops or not mowing the grass or mowing and bagging the grass, plowing under fields, things like that. Some of those are, of course, less geared toward urban areas, but again, we're thinking about incidents like Chernobyl with a lot of agriculture concerns, much more than urban areas, at least more widespread. And another of the intermediate phase PAGs is the FDA food PAG. Here's another one where EPA doesn't craft this PAG, FDA does, and EPA adopts it and defers to the FDA. So the food PAG is listed as half a REM to the whole body, or 5 REM to the most exposed organ or tissue. That's actually sounding outdated to me, but I'm going to look at that. and that was published in 1998, and it's reprinted in the 92 PAG. But on our website, if you Google EPA PAG, we come right up, and we've got the updated FDA food PAGs there. And again, that food PAG is really directed at incidents like the Chernobyl one, where foodstuffs were contaminated. The people around there didn't have a lot of choices for alternate foods, and so were exposed to quite a bit of cesium and mostly radioiodine. Okay, so Craig, I'm sorry, I realize I didn't answer your question. It's 5 REM child. The KI PAG from FDA published in 2001 is 5 rem projected dose to the child's thyroid. There are a whole bunch of other levels in the FDA guidance, but that's the most limiting one, so that's what we're going with. I just forgot to convert the international units when I updated my slides. So I hope that answers that. So I'm going to move on to the next slide. This is slide 29. About the late phase. Now, I mentioned before that the late phase is really not part of emergency response. This is a long-term cleanup, potentially a very long-term cleanup. Again, looking at the Japan example, that's going to be a very long-term cleanup that's underway now, but probably won't be completed for years and years to come. The late phase is this cleanup and restoration phase. The Protective Action Guides manual does not address the late phase and just focuses on emergency response instead. So now I'm moving on to slide 30, and reminding everyone that even though the 92 PAGs are old and we are working on updating them, there are a lot of tools and guides and electronic gadgets that are available to help implement protective action guides, to learn about them and to use them properly. In fact, a lot of these tools have gone a long way to update what is in the 1992 PAGs. FIRMAC, our partners at the Federal Radiological Monitoring and Assessment Center, have run a lot of calculations and developed a dose assessment tool that incorporates updated science so that you don't have to go to the back of the 92 PAGs and look at tables that are based on, you know, 1960s science. So reminding ourselves that the Protective Action Guides manual, while it is picked up in regulations, especially around nuclear power plants, they are simply guidance. No one says that one must use exactly what's in that book. Many states implement their own PAGs that are either more conservative or more appropriate for the types of incidents that they're preparing for. So when you go on the web, you can find tools, and I'll show you a couple that I think are especially useful to implement PAGs and to make sure you're using the most updated materials. On slide 31, there's a screenshot from the ResRad RDD tools. This is something that's on the web. You can go on DOE's Operational Guidelines website and sign up, and you can get a copy of the Operational Guidelines book, which is another 300-page fun read. And the associated software tool is ResRad RDD. I'm sure several of you are familiar with this. It's an awesome tool that helps you implement PAGS Plus, I would call it. Even further than the PAGs, the operational guidelines help answer questions about return and reentry, which is exactly the point where the Japanese are right now, where they're trying to answer questions about what residual doses might be of concern, where are the areas that people can move back in, where are the areas where businesses can start back up despite a remaining contamination situation. So these numeric guides are written up in the operational guidelines, and you can get the software tool from the website there. Moving on to slide 32, here's another updated guidance that was issued in 2008. Department of Homeland Security, looking at the potential for radiological terrorism, which after 9/11 was suddenly very much on our minds, where a nuclear power plant accident is one thing, but a dirty bomb or a nuclear detonation is a completely different thing. So the Department of Homeland Security issued this guidance. It's multi-agency guidance that basically looked at the EPA PAGs and said, EPA PAGs are good, and they should be used in this type of incident. And it expanded the scope further, basically, to RDDs and INDs. That's on the web, published in 2008. Now I'm moving on to slide 33. Here's another updated guide that kind of goes over and above what the PAGs do. This is for specifically for urban nuclear detonations. This is another multi-agency guidance published out of the White House. In 2010, we issued a second edition, and it really helps address the fact that for the first 72 hours and longer after an urban nuclear detonation, really PAGs are not going to work out that well. There are so many horrible and unique characteristics of an urban nuclear detonation that we can envision that numeric PAGs really don't do the trick. Emergency planning has to involve a lot of special circumstances related to the fallout and the high radiation doses, the infrastructure damage, and potential total lack of communication tools. So that's a very good read. I've listed the EPA webpage where we've posted that, but that's on several different websites. Now I'm moving on to slide 34. I pointed out when I was talking about potassium iodide that the Food and Drug Administration guidance is more recent than the 92 PAGs. That was issued in 2001. So there's the website to go find that on FDA's webpage. They also have some frequently asked questions, which are very useful. They go further than the guidance does about how to implement a potassium iodide program. And there's a screenshot there for one of the tools that's very useful, especially for a nuclear power plant incident, RASCL. I can't remember what RASCL stands for. It's probably like radiological assessment, but I won't guess. It's an acronym.
System for consequence analysis.
See, you're right good, there. Catherine. Radiological Assessment System for Consequence Analysis. That's a piece of cake. The RASCL tool was developed by Nuclear Regulatory Commission to help do radiological dose assessment in the case of a nuclear power plant incident. So it's one of those great tools that I think you should definitely check out. I think it's one that you can request on the web, but you can't download yourself on the web. But it's yet another of those tools that helps get you further faster than the 92 PAGs. So now I'm moving to slide 35. I also mentioned the Food and Drug Administration updated their food PAG, and there's the website where you can get that. That was published in 1998. And moving on to slide 36, there's just a couple covers of some implementation guides, some first responder guide for an RDD or dirty bomb on the left from the Conference of Radiation Control Program Directors, and on the right, a guide for local and state organizations who would have to deal with potentially monitoring members of the public, a lot of them, if there was a large radiological contamination event. And that comes from the Centers for Disease Control. Did someone have a question out there? Okay, with that, I've moved to slide 37, and I'll open it up for questions, comments, any clarifications I can make on my slides, other than that good catch that Craig got. No comments?
On the PAG.
Wow. Great. So now I'm going to hand it back over to Catherine, who's going to talk to us about MRSM.
All right, we're moving on to slide number 38. What we're looking at here is MRSM Revision 2. I am the MRSM Work Group Chair, and if you don't know what MRSM stands for, I will get to that. It's a big acronym. Just kind of showing some pictures where I can, I'm going to go over the documents a little bit. This picture is from an EPA Region 2 Superfund site. You can see that radiation cleanup site's really kind of what we're working on here. It's a multi-agency document, so we're going to be looking at these kinds of sites on all different parts of the country and all different agencies. Go ahead and move on. All right, the MRSM work group, MRSM stands for Multi-Agency Radiation Survey and Site Investigation Manual. It is an independently chartered work group. We've been under the ISCORS umbrella since 2007, ISCORS, another acronym. The Interagency Steering Committee on Radiation Standards. ISCORS is actually an eight-agency working group that includes all of the federal agencies that promulgate radiation standards. MRSM does not have anything to do with radiation standards, but it was pointed out that many of our management structures were on ISCORS, so it seemed like a convenient place for MRSM to report. Four federal agencies are currently included in the MRSM work group. We have the Department of Defense, independently represented by the three different forces. Air Force, Army, and Navy all have representatives on the work group, as well as the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We have a pretty strong working relationship with CRCPD, the Conference for Radiation Control Protection Directors.
Program Directors.
Program Directors. I was close. Which is kind of a group of state agencies that
kind of do the radiation work for their particular state. Depending on the state, that may be a different agency. Some it's in health, some it's environment, and so kind of CRCPD gathers all of those organizations together. We have a pretty strong working relationship with that particular organization, kind of as our sister regulators on a lot of these sites. This work group operates by consensus. As you might imagine, these four federal agencies don't always see eye to eye on everything. So in order to agree on anything big, we do have to have all four federal agencies agree. Three agencies must be present before we will have meetings and conference calls. So if there's any major concerns, we'll even make sure all four of them are present before we move forward with anything in particular. Moving on to slide number 41, we'll talk about some of the documents here just to give you an overview of what's out there currently, and then we'll move on to talking about the revision 2 of MARSIM. There's three MAR documents. Kind of we think of them as the MAR series documents. MARSIM, Survey and Site Investigation Manual, published in 1997. Revision 1 was published in 2001. So the most recent version of MARSIM, now 10 years old, one reason why we're working on revision 2 to that. MARSAME, another seven-letter acronym, Multi-Agency Radiation Survey and Assessment of Materials and Equipment, is a supplement to MARSIM, published in 2009. MARLAP, Multi-Agency Radiation Laboratory Analytical Protocols. That's actually run out of a different work group, though related. John Griggs from our Montgomery laboratory is actually the lead for MARLAP. Now, these are technical documents. They're not policy. They're not even officially guidance. These are meant to be technical documents, possibly best practices, and applied as the four agencies see best. So we'll move forward to 42, where we have an overview of MARSIM. MARSIM covers real property as opposed to unreal property, which we make that joke. We actually talk about that, which is specifically our scope is limited to surface soils and building surfaces. As you might imagine, that leaves quite a few things out. The idea behind MARSIM is to provide a defensible and rigorous survey for final status surveys. We're trying to take what information we know about a site, develop a survey of it, a radiological survey of it, with a graded approach so that you actually use a greater amount of effort for those sites that have a greater possibility for residual radioactivity above whatever is the level you're concerned about. MARSIM recommends a two-tiered approach for surveys using scanning and direct measurements or samples to determine whether or not your site meets whatever criteria you're working with. Now we'll move on to 43. There it is. MARSIM is fairly widely used. It is used at NRC decommissioning sites and at some DOE, EPA, and DOD and state cleanup sites. It's often found at sites where there's multi-party cleanup agreements because multiple federal agencies have already kind of agreed to this approach. It's been final in 1997, and it's been around now for 14 years. There's fairly extensive experience in using MARSIM out there in the community. We'll move on to slide number 44. MARSIM is kind of our baby document. It's only a couple of years old now. It's meant to be a supplement to MARSIM. This particular document is meant to cover not building surfaces and surface soils, but those things that are not tacked down, materials and equipment. Often we talk about if a building is going to be left in place and reoccupied, that's going to be MARSIM. If you intend to knock it down and cart it off as waste, that's going to be MARSAM. It's going to become a material. If you've got soil, you're going to leave the soil undisturbed on the site, you use MARSIM. If you're going to dig it up, put it in a pile, and haul it off someplace, that's going to be MARSAM. So the line between the two of them is very, very close. In terms of Marseille, the survey is pretty much identical no matter when you're performing the survey. It could be part of cleanup, day-to-day operations, or as an interdiction survey, actually trying to catch something with radioactive materials in it that was not necessarily supposed to have it there. Once again, it's going to use process knowledge, what you know about the materials there, and a graded approach. One of the more difficult things about Marseille is that it addresses not just surficial, but volumetric contamination in difficult-to-measure areas. We had thought this was going to be relatively easy. After Marsim, we were just going to extend the scope, kind of look at, you know, a few extra things and issue Marsim, and then we realized how difficult that was going to be. There are different geometries of contamination, difficult-to-measure areas. We're looking at inhomogeneous materials. When I say that, I mean electric drill that is made out of plastic and metal and various types of metal, and we're looking at, there's many more things you can do with materials. I mean, with a site, you could pretty much, you could release it completely, you could release it for restricted use, or you could hold on to it. With materials, you have so many options what you can do with those. It ended up being a lot more complicated than we had planned. It's a less prescriptive guidance for that reason than Marsim. There's many more scenarios it's meant to cover. Marsim also could have been done on paper with a calculator. I suppose you could do away with the calculator if you wanted to. You could do it with pen and paper. A couple of lookup charts was really all you needed. Marsim is going to require computer software. It's a much more complicated document to do. Go ahead and move on. MARLAP is the last document in this series. It's really meant to cover radiation and their laboratory analytical protocols. It's in the same category because it still covers radiation measurements. That's where the connection comes amongst the three documents. But really, since this was such a specialized area working in the laboratory, we developed a whole separate work group that had that kind of knowledge base and included additional federal agencies you see there. USGS, DHS, FDA, and NIST were included in this one as well. So we'll move on to slide number 46, talking about kind of what planned revisions to MARSIM we have coming up. This particular picture is courtesy of EPA's Radiation and Indoor Environments National Laboratory, their coastal bayou site, which is now a cleanup site 10 years ago, plus, as it were. Moving on to slide number 47, why revise MARSIM? MARSIM has not been updated since 2001. There were a number of errata pages and a revision 1 issued in 2001, mostly typos, clarifications, and so on, but no real significant changes in any of the science or the technical information included. So really after 10 years, most of that time spent trying to work on Marsim, looking back at Marsim, a lot of things have come up that I think we would change now looking back on that date. So moving on to slide 48, this is kind of our initial list of planned revisions. We've got an updated treatment of measurement uncertainty, and I'll actually just move on to slide 49 because that provides more detail on this. MARSIM and MARLAP, being much newer documents, are in line with the state of the science regarding measurement uncertainty. As John Griggs from NARAL tends to tell me, it's the science of metrology, the science of measurement. NIST specifically, ISO and NIST have developed current guidance on this. It's an incredibly rigorous process for determining measurement uncertainty. MARSIM does not include that, and it does add a layer of complication to these documents, but also a layer of scientific rigor that is needed. So that's going to be included. On slide 50, you'll see that we're hoping to update measurement methods. MARSIM, though issued in 1997, was actually kind of finished. The writing was finished on it in 1995. And it was written with that current measurement technology in mind. At the time, scanning, specifically scanning instruments, were not able to meet the kinds of requirements that were out there for sites. It was pretty much a foregone conclusion that you were going to need to take direct measurements or send samples off to the lab, one or both, in order to really get the kind of accuracy you needed with your samples. As it is, scanning has improved. We have seen a number of presentations in the intervening years where people have really worked hard, especially on building surfaces, homogeneous building surfaces, to come up with scanning technologies that don't require additional fixed samples to be taken. With that in mind, we're going to try and update MRSIM to take that into account and not to limit ourselves to the current technology, but open ourselves up to the possibility that radiation measurement technology may continue to improve into the future. And those options are possible if you can prove that they do work at your site. To, once again, the level of uncertainty that is required, that would be the last slide. So moving on to slide number 51, another revision that we're looking at for MRSIM Rev 2, scenario B. This is referred to as assumed to pass until proven otherwise. Those of you who are familiar with this kind of hypothesis testing, you know that we often try to prove that something is guilty unless you prove otherwise. I mean, something is guilty until you prove otherwise. The site is contaminated until you prove that it's not. And you design your survey to prove that it's not contaminated, to prove your hypothesis wrong. Unfortunately, when your action level, when your criteria is zero, or when your action level is indistinguishable from background or zero added residual or zero residual radioactivity above background, it's very hard to prove that you're less than zero, which is really what that would require. In that particular case, you're almost stuck with the opposite, which is assume that it passes unless you prove otherwise. That's scenario B. MRSIM allows the use of scenario B, and there's a number of states and other locations where they really worked with scenario B because they are looking at zero residual radioactivity at a site. They've really had to turn to that. We're looking at changing MRSIM to make that an option within the document itself. So we'll be adding that in. Not just keeping in mind, and of course we'll put in the strongest language possible, saying that you still have to do a very good survey when you're doing scenario B. With scenario A, which is you assume that you're guilty unless you prove otherwise, it's really in your best interest to do an excellent survey. I have to do the best survey possible to disprove my hypothesis. If you're assumed to pass until you prove otherwise, it's almost in your best interest to do the least amount of surveying possible. I waved a broom over my site. I didn't prove that I didn't pass, so therefore I must pass. Unfortunately, that kind of thing can happen. So it's going to be tougher with scenario B. It's going to be a little bit more onus on the regulators to make sure that that those surveys are really as rigorous as they need to be using that scenario. So we'll move on to slide number 52. This follows so nicely afterwards. Increased emphasis on regulator interaction during survey design. I can't tell you how many times during the last 10 years I've had regulators come to me, state regulators, NRC regulators, and others come to me and say, can you make them stop? And the MRSIM work group, of course, says, we just publish technical documents. We have no force over anyone. You're the regulator, sadly. We can't do anything much to help you. We're finding regulators coming to us and saying they're coming to us with already completed surveys. When we look at the surveys that have been done, they weren't done nearly to the level that they needed to be done. They're doing class 3 surveys, which are kind of the lowest level of effort in areas that really required a class 1 survey or the greatest level of effort. They're choosing parameters throughout the design process that decrease cost but also decrease the rigor of the survey. I think the best we can do as the work group is to really emphasize that it's in your best interest to interact regularly with your regulator during survey design while you're designing these surveys, so that you don't get to the end and say, hey, here's my survey, I'm all done, and have the regulator go, no, you're not, which is unfortunately what some of them have been driven to do. Kind of to make sure that everyone is satisfied with the survey that is done once it is completed. So we will put in some additional language in there emphasizing that and trying to give people some waypoints, some important decision points where it's in your best interest to get regulator buy-in on those points. Lessons learned. 14 years of using this particular document. People have been handing their comments into us, especially where they say, gosh, this is confusing. This doesn't work. This hasn't worked for us. This is the workaround we've come up with. When I say significant lessons learned on both sides, I would say on the regulator side and on the side of those designing and performing the surveys, I think we've learned where people have found more efficient ways to do things, different ways to do things, and preferred ways to do things. And I think we'll incorporate as many of those as we can into the revisions. On slide 54, just a few other things. We're going to just try and make everything consistent. We've now got three documents. We need to keep all of our terms consistent. That's pretty basic. On slide 55, we're going to do a better job of discussing hotspots and UMTRCA standards. UMTRCA standards are somewhat unusual, and they are not included in the original MARSIM. The reason I call them unusual is that MARSIM assumes that you're coming into the survey with some sort of dose or risk-based criteria that your regulator has specified. MARSIM doesn't cover where you get that from because, frankly, the four agencies don't agree on that process. So what we don't agree on is not in our document. So you're coming into the process, you already have that from whatever regulatory regime you're working under, and we assume that it's dose or risk-based. UMTRCA is a little different in the way that it's set up. It already has an averaging area that is included in that, and frankly, MARSIM doesn't work with that currently. Just to make sure that there's no confusion on that part, we're going to include a statement where we address UMTRCA and the surveys done for UMTRCA and, you know, reiterate what can be done there, just to make sure that there's no confusion between the two. That's how we're going to address UMTRCA, kind of the best I can explain it at this point. In terms of hotspots, what we're really looking at here are area factors. This is a bit complicated to try and explain, I suppose. What we're looking at here really is if you have an area of contamination on your site which is smaller than the entire survey unit you're looking at, but yet is much higher than your release criterion, such that there is a possibility that just that one small area alone over that area might exceed your dose or risk criterion. We're looking at, you know, when you're looking at a site and you're averaging over an entire site, there's the possibility that you might have missed a hot spot in your sampling process. We want to make sure that we don't miss those. So we include those as a kind of a separate test. You're testing for hot spots in sites where that's a possibility. You need to make sure that you're not going to exceed your dose or risk criterion based on those hot spots. Well, in theory, that works great. In practice, this has been very challenging to implement. I say that very honestly, and I think we've heard that kind of over and over again. What happens if you have more than one hotspot? How do you work with that? What happens if you've got multiple radionuclides in your area? How do you work all of that out? It's not quite as easy as we'd like for it to be. We've had several suggestions for how to improve this process that have been given to us by some very learned and knowledgeable folks, and we're going to consider those pretty aggressively in our future works.
There's a question about whether training is going to be offered anytime soon.
Yes,
thank you for asking. As a matter of fact, and this is a great question to ask, because we've just scheduled MARSIM training at the facility, the California DTSC facility in Berkeley, California. It's scheduled for October 25th through 27th, 2011. So specifically to answer your question and where you're located, that's going to be MARSIM training. We also have MARSIM training scheduled for September, I think it's 20th through 22nd, 2011, in Richland, Washington. We will have MARSIM training coming up in 2012. That's not yet scheduled, the locations. I'm currently talking to the state of Missouri, who's interested in hosting a site, and we'll see where else we go from there. So hopefully that answers that question. All right, moving on to slide number 56. Where can you find out what we're working on? Go to our website. It's under EPA, but if you honestly go to Google and you search under MARSIM, it's the first link that pops up as our MARSIM workgroup website. We'll keep you updated. We've got our annual meeting is next week. We'll have all four federal agencies here in Washington, D.C. to discuss kind of the final decisions, determinations on some of these updates. Some of them are pretty set, and some of them we still have to discuss. So decisions, I think, will be made this next week. We've received a lot of comments as part of an extensive public comment solicitation period. We're going to respond to all of those. If you've submitted comments, I want you to know we've looked at all of them very seriously. We've received great comments from some very knowledgeable folks, from ORISE, from the Army Corps of Engineers, from the Health Physics Society, from CRCPD, and so on, have all taken a very serious look at the documents and submitted some very knowledgeable comments. And we will respond to all of those. We'll do it when we put out MARSIM Revision 2 for review. So that's going to be part of our Federal Register Notice process there. Now, I think that might be it. There it is. There's our logo. And that is the end of what I had here to say on MARSIM Revision 2. I can answer questions about MARSIM or MARSANE or anything about the revisions if anyone has any.
This is Michelle Mahoney. While we're waiting for people to submit some questions either online or to speak up on the phone line, I'd like to encourage everyone to move to slide 58, where you'll see a link to additional resources, and then also our feedback form that I mentioned at the beginning of the webinar. If you could take some time to fill that out so we can see what kind of webinars you'd like to see in the future.
And Michelle, I think that might be it. Unless we hear from someone, I think that is the end of what presentations we have to bring before you today.
Okay, great. Yeah, it was very informative. I enjoyed it. And I guess if anyone comes up with a question, they can just email you guys. Well, we have one that just came in online.
Oh, great. Can we get back there? I think I missed it. Can you tell us what it says?
Sure, I can read it to you. It says, what kind of tabletop exercises do you do to ensure that new people understand what is going on? And this comes from Camille in Florida.
Well, actually, we were just talking about something that we use to keep our EPA radiation dose assessors up to speed with new tools and kind of keep the spear sharp, if you will. And what we do is we always do a refresher on PAGs and the tables, the way the derived response levels are used to compare to either lab samples or measurements made in the field. And so we usually do a primer and a refresher training just to keep our dose assessors up to speed and give them a little practice. And then what we do is we always kind of do quiz questions based on scenarios that we either borrow from nuclear power plant exercises or scenarios that we've developed in-house. And we throw a few radiation measurements in various formats at our radiological dose assessors and see how they do, if they can look through the right resources and come up with answers about whether the PAGs might be exceeded. That's the sort of stuff that we do internally. So we always do webinar, phone, email-based because, again, we have people in 13 different locations in the U.S., so, yeah, we don't have any travel money either. So we're getting really pretty good at the phone and webinar type training. I will promise that EPA will offer up more in the way of PAGS training coming up in the next year or so. We've been hesitant to provide a lot of training because we were in the middle of this update process, this revision process, and we didn't want to train on something that potentially could change during the process. But I think it's always important to share those resources when possible and not just use them for our own dose assessors.
Similarly, just to answer, I think we're kind of moving into the second question. We've got a question about since some states' budgets cannot support travel, what training will be provided through the web? MARSIM training is provided via webinar as well. There will be two classes held in 2012 that are a MARSIM webinar. I think one of them is going to be held via the EPA webinar system. And the second will be actually offered through the Department of Defense webinar system. Amazingly, our information systems don't communicate very well. So in order to make sure that training gets out to the Department of Defense, we'll be working through one of those. I find it likely. All of the training on MARSIM is on TRAINEX. If you've ever been to www.trainex.org, you can search there on MARSIM, MARSAIM, or MARLAP and find the current offerings for those trainings.
Great. Well, thanks, Catherine and Sarah. It was a great presentation. Is there anyone on the phone that has any last-minute questions? Okay, well, I appreciate everyone's attention today. And with that's the end of today's webinar. Thank you very much.